Joel Fleischman, February 8, 1974. Fleischman is director of the Institute of Policy Sciences and Public Affairs at Duke University, former legal assistant to Terry Sanford when he was governor.
Let me start off by asking this question.
No particular order of consequence, because I haven't really had a chance to think about it, and we'll just have to sort it out as we go. I think that there is, there are several things that have made a difference. In the first place, the increasing numbers of blacks who are registered, and the increasing proportion, though it varies, of their participation in politics is making a difference now. I mean, you couldn't very well have had the millions, I don't know what the exact figure is, somewhere between 2 and 3 million blacks registered in the 1960s without having a consequence on the election. So you are seeing it in the election of black office holders, as well as presumably, though we're not sure about that, a change in actual policy outputs, of which should tend to give blacks a better share of the public policy expenditures. I think that's one difference. I think that's going to be strengthened. I think that's a fragile kind of thing in some areas, though in the large metropolitan areas it probably isn't, unless it leads, as it has tended to do in some places, into a kind of polarization of the black and white community, in which event the gains might very well be frustrated. But as you develop more black ownership, through land ownership, or just through a large middle class that's employed in a variety of other institutions, I think you're going to get much more stable black politics, much more influential black politics throughout the South. It's already showing itself in obvious ways, and no point in belaboring that. I think secondly, you're getting a lot more of local grassroots kind of political activity, mainly a phenomenon of the 60s. I think that has waned a little bit, but I think it's still an important factor to take into account, especially when you consider it along with the increasing black political participation. That's a characteristic not only of the 60s, but it's a characteristic in some degrees of the kind of politics which has occurred in other parts of the country. You think of it as the New York and California syndrome, almost, but that's coming along with urbanization and a greater political consciousness because of television and other things to the South. That's making a difference, too. I'm not sure how important that is in the long run, though I think it is important. I think it's a definite change over a political system that was basically elite-run. At least in North Carolina, it was elite-run. I'm not sure that you could say that it was elite-run in Alabama, not at least in the same sense of elite, or in some of the other states. It varies from state to state. You would know that more better than I would. But that's a factor. I think you can also separate out from that the factor of urbanization. As the South has become more urbanized and will continue to get more urbanized, I think that factor is going to in itself have an important shaping role on our politics. We've never had large urban areas in the South, and consequently we've never had the kinds of divisions between urban and rural areas that other states have had. And again, you think about New York and New York City versus the rest of the state, the upstate areas, or Chicago versus the downstate areas. We've never had that kind of division in North Carolina. all we've had is a gentlemanly understanding that Senate seats would rotate and governorships would rotate between East and West, but there's never really been the kind of urban-rural divisions. And I think we're going to have that. Atlanta is about the only place that I know of in the state, in the South, that that has really had a marked division. New Orleans, to some degree, between New Orleans and the rest of the state, but I don't think it was anywhere near as severe as it's been in some of these, in some of the other northern states. But I think it's going to get to be. When you couple with that kind, with the growth of urban areas, particularly dominant urban areas, the fragmentation in politics that is occurring because of the increasing grassroots participation, the proliferation of articulate interest groups, the increasing importance of the black vote, you know, I think that we're going to have a much more, I think we already have a much more diverse, dynamic, unstable kind of politics in the South than we've ever had before. It's much more difficult for organizations, even good organizations, to continue to control the situation because there are too many elements in each organizational structuring at an election that are variable and that move from that can chip away or at the slightest the provocation. And it, I think we're out of the time when you could have, as we had in North Carolina, a Shelby machine that dominated the Democratic Party for 15 or 20 years, you know, or a liberal Sanford organization, either. And I don't see that. I see that phenomenon as being gone at this point, given the state of political leadership that we've got. I mean, it's conceivable that a master politician like Franklin Roosevelt could come along and reunite and dominate a particular group of interest groups over a long period of time, but we don't have political leadership of that stature.
Can we examine that point for a moment?
Sure.
One of the people we've interviewed described the Democratic Party as a bird.
In North Carolina,
as a bird with no head and a whole lot of wings flapping all over the place. The Sanford wing, you know, maybe the old branch head boys, the Taylor wing, the Bowles wing. How do you see that?
I think that's absolutely true. What see, the problem, as I see it, is that it was possible before when you had a small number of kinds of groups, it was possible for group alignments to remain stable even under a lesser condition, a lesser stature of political leadership. Because you had less groups to manipulate, in a sense, and you could and less groups to satisfy, so the alignments tended to be stable. There weren't very many groups. I mean, there were small numbers of networks around which, as long as you controlled which, it would be possible to build winning coalitions. But there were essentially small groups, which formed the core. Now there are just many more. And that's a phenomenon, it seems to me, of the black vote, of grassroots politics, of urbanization, which make it, you've got too many floating groups at this point to have any kind of dominant political leadership. That's the problem with the Democratic Party in North Carolina today, and I'm not sure that it's terribly different from the problems in other states, except that we are probably more advanced in terms of this, whether it's better or worse is another question, but we're more advanced in the process of this fragmentation of politics, so that it's impossible with the stature of leadership that we've got now to maintain any kind of effective continuity over a continuing influence over those groups.
Joel, can you point to a specific election or event that was kind of the watershed of this sort of thing? Was the turning point? Where it was no longer possible to hold together the small number.
Well,
of blacks,
I suppose the first sign when the blacks started running their own candidate for governor, I don't know what the first year was that Hawkins ran. Was it 19? Was it 68 or was it 68?
It had to be 68.
It was 68. I think that's one of the first signs of it. When blacks, identified their interest out, separated their interest out from that of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, or at least whether for tactical reasons or for otherwise, that probably was the first stage in the proceeding. Because once that occurred, then it permitted a large number of radical, left of center to radical white groups, including some of the organized labor, some of the peace groups, some of the civil liberties groups, some of the intellectual groups, to have another option in terms of their identification with political, with any kind of political organization. Prior to that, it didn't exist. And prior to that, it was, you identified with the Sanford wing or the Frank Graham wing of the Democratic Party. After that occurred, there were other options. And I suppose if I had to, that's the most visible kind of watershed, it seems to me. And I think that's a problem that's going to be with us for a long time. I think that because the black vote has always been the largest single vote that could be counted on for the liberal wing of the Democratic Party in North Carolina and probably throughout the South. Once that separated out and became its own wing, in a sense, and had to be taken into account, it became very difficult at that point to mobilize the kind of winning coalition. I don't know what percentage, you know this, what was the percentage of blacks who voted in the 1968 gubernatorial election as compared to the 1972 gubernatorial election? It would be interesting to take a look at it. I mean, obviously blacks constitute about 25-27% of the population of North Carolina. I don't think they vote in those proportions. I think they probably vote about 15%, but that's still that's a hell of a big chunk, and it's always been the main single discrete element of the winning liberal coalition in the Senate.
Was Scott perceived as the liberal candidate in 68?
Well, as things finally came down.
In the primary?
Yeah, he was perceived as a liberal candidate. There's no question about it. Yeah, he was the liberal candidate. The problem was that he, like so many of the liberal candidates prior to that point, Terry is about the only exception that I know of. I guess it was Rich Pryor was an exception too. The liberal candidates always felt that they could count on the blacks and the liberals to come with them, and therefore where they needed really to watch their flanks was on the right, so that they could afford to do a little bit of black beating in public in order to get more votes in the center and to the right. That's exactly what Bob Scott did. He felt he could take for granted the blacks and other liberals because of the fact that they didn't have anybody else to vote for, essentially. That proved to be correct in his election. I'm not sure that it proves to be correct anymore. And one of Skipper's mistakes was, in a sense, not really the kind of coolness and aloofness from the black political leadership and public association with blacks. I think that cost him some votes, and it was it's a very tricky thing now to given the high visibility and the active participation of black leadership, it makes it just much more complicated to work out a winning liberal coalition. Never been any problem working out a winning conservative coalition.
Well, the last you say that Scott represented a winning liberal coalition.
Well, I don't think Scott was a liberal. That's one of the problems. Scott's a populist. His father was a populist. Bob Scott ran, as you all know, simply because he was his father's son. He inherited the branch at Boys, and he inherited a significant proportion of whatever the liberal vote was in North Carolina.
Has there been a liberal governor in North Carolina since then?
No, there hasn't.
Was Terry Sanford's election an accident?
No, I don't think it was an accident. The difference was that Terry decided that he was. It's much harder, and you start in the assumption it's much harder for liberals to get elected anywhere, well, at least in the South, in a basically conservative political culture with which has a lot of demons in its mind, it's very hard for liberals to win in the South. Terry started running for governor 6 years before he was elected. He put together a network of really good of political leadership all over the state. That's the kind of that is the kind of organization that liberals have to have in order to win in the South. You got to have dedication, persistence. You got to go at it for a long time, and you got to have a solid organization. You had a brilliant campaign manager. Just the whole, it was a question of putting the thing together very carefully. And when he went into the election, he was very strong, and because he had planned the thing. The problem with liberals is, they tend, at least the new liberals, tend to want instant success. Feel that people will vote simply on the basis of the right, as they perceive it, on the basis of ideology, and therefore they don't need to worry about all of the messy political details of putting together an organization, of building it, and of extending it. And as a consequence, it's just been very. Terry is an exception to the extent that he's one of the few people who has both that kind of political dedication and instinct, and also happens to have ideals and liberal ideals. That's just simply not the case. I mean, when Rich Fire ran, Rich ran as our candidate. But the problem is, in North Carolina, we know that we've never been able to transfer political loyalty from one candidate to another. We never did bring along the people. And Rich didn't have his own campaign organization. It was clearly was a derivative from Sanford and Bennett.
You explain his regional success and also the feeling of loyalty that engenders among people since that time.
Terry?
To his organizational skills and the fact that he...
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I think that, I don't think that's what I'm saying. You can't factor the two out. He would never have gotten to be governor, given the things that he believes in, if he had not spent 4 to 6 years organizing the state.
No, but nobody talks about a Dan Moore wing or a Bob Scott wing or...
No, but that's because they talked about the Frank Graham wing before Terry was elected. There was a discrete group, but they just hadn't ever won an election. And no, they don't talk about a Dan Moore wing. They will never talk about a Bob Scott wing. There may be still the Carr Scott wing, but that's really been substantially subsumed, except for the more racist elements of the group, into the Sanford wing.
So what did Sanford basically put together? What coalition? What was his coalition?
He put together basically a coalition of people who were primarily loyal to him, but either through knowing him beforehand or through having gotten to know him in the process of organizing for the governorship. He put together. And that was, in many ways, an entirely different group. There were essentially two groups in the Sanford campaign. One of them were people who were primarily loyal to Terry and who didn't care a thing about what he believed in, necessarily. Many of them became converted ideologically later on once he became governor. But they were essentially loyal to him. They trusted him. They didn't really care what he believed in, particularly. They were responding to him as an individual and as they perceived him a political leader. Many people in the campaign had never been active in politics before. Substantial business types, lawyers, and others who had just hadn't taken a role in politics before. Many of them were young at that particular point, too, and hadn't been active in politics. The other group were the people whom Terry had ideologically associated with, the Frank Graham wing of the Democratic Party. The liberals, the blacks, and their liberal patrons, some of the labor leaders, the general makings of the liberal wing of any Democratic political party, and he attracted them very much too. And when you put together his personal loyalists with the ideological loyalists, you had a winning coalition. But liberals can't win without that first component, and none of the other people that have run have had that. It takes hard work to build that up, and that's something that liberals just are prone just to forget. They somehow think that they're going to win because right is on their side. But they don't win because of that. They've got, it requires incredible organization.
Is there an organization left?
The Sanford organization is left. It is not as strong as it could be. Many of the people have died. Many of the people have formed other loyalties. Basically, it's still left. Terry could have won the primary if he had organized the thing. It was the most poorly organized thing I've ever seen in politics, the Wallace primary.
And why did he get into it? You take a look at his history. He's really cold in terms of political decisions. You know the war's going to come out. You take a look at that thing. It was a loser from the beginning.
Got into it partially because of his presidential ambitions and partially, it was a classic situation of conflict of goals. He did not want to lead Duke. He both did not want to lead Duke, and he wanted to win the election. And he compromised the solution in such a way as to announce late, which he should have never done if he were going to do it. But the reason he announced late was because of the fact that he wanted to be sure that he consulted extensively with trustees and faculty and students and alumni, and the process took about 6 weeks or more. Once I knew that he was going to run, once I heard that he was thinking about it, I counseled him very strongly against it because I knew that it couldn't be run right. And the group that he put together was just terrible. The election was
so. All of his old political advisors tell us the same thing, that they all counseled against him.
Well, we did. And you know, it's a measure of the fact that he felt that it was important to oppose Wallace down here, that nobody else would do it. He also felt that he could win the election without really having the thing well organized. And that, in a sense, was the lesson of it, that you can't, no matter how prominent the person is here, no matter how following he may have, can't do it. It requires work. Every election requires extensive organization. They didn't even have the county. 60% of the county.
When he pushed the button on the old organization, nothing happened.
Well, that's right, because it requires continuous activation. It requires repeated activation. It won't work.
But you still
there.
It's
like any other. You know, you remember what I said earlier? I said it is always a question, or at least with him, it's been a question, of having a personal group which then went to work. The personal group isn't going to vote. If you counted all the votes of the people who are in the Sanford organization, you might not have more than 2,000 or 3,000 votes in North Carolina, maybe more than that, but not more than 10,000 votes. But what the difference is, they have to have time to activate their friends and organize in the counties and the cities and the state. That never happened. You know, it was 5 weeks from the time that he first decided that he was going to run until the time the primary took place, or to the time he announced he was going to run until the time the primary took place. They hadn't even gotten, there were not more than 30% of the county managers that had been announced at that point.
But you don't think that decision in that race has hurt him at all in terms of?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about the fact that it hurt him. If he had won the primary, he would have gone into the convention in Miami much stronger and probably come out with twice as many votes. Once he lost that primary, I think he hampered his chances considerably. I mean, not that he ever had a chance of getting the nomination last time, but he would have come in with a much better showing. He would have had, I would guess, somewhere between 200 and 225 votes if he had won that primary. But he lost it. And I think that having his decision to go ahead with the stay on in even after the primary enabled him to become a more credible candidate this time, I think. I think the primary still will hang over him because anybody who couldn't carry North Carolina at that point, if given the position that Terry was in, obviously is damaged in the perception that others have.
Now, you think in organizational terms, the Sanford wing, if you want to call it that, is still the most powerful organizational entity in the Democratic Party?
Only, yes, I think in the abstract it probably is. But it's no more powerful than any other group unless it's activated. And the problem is that you have to activate it each time.
on his behalf.
No, I'm not sure that it has to be necessarily activated on his behalf. I think that's a question which varies, depends on whose behalf it's being activated for. It depends on the context. While we thought, you know, that as close to the election, as close, we thought we could activate it on behalf of Rich Pryor. It turned out that in fact there was too much going against Terry at that point, as well as too little going for Rich at that point for the thing to work. And I think both of them were very important. At this point, I think it's conceivable that it could be activated for somebody else, but you know, that, as I say, we don't have a tradition in North Carolina of being able to, of governors or other political leaders being able to transfer their loyalty. And in that sense, it's unlike the classic concept of a political organization that you have in other places where the organization can deliver for anybody. We've never had that kind of organization here after, to a certain extent, I think it did with the Shelby machine from the 30s down to when Carr Scott beat it. And even then it lingered over some into the 50s. But we've never, other than that, they could apparently deliver for anybody. Since that time, we've not had that kind of organization.
Is the traditional source of Democratic financing in North Carolina shifting over to the Republican Party?
I don't think so. What has happened? Well, let me modify that. I think that some of the traditional source of Democratic support, the very conservative right wing of the Democratic Party, some of that is going over to the Republicans, but I don't think an awful lot. I don't think we ever tapped a lot of the Republican money in the Democratic primaries. If one looks at the fundraising for the 1972 gubernatorial race, I don't think there's any necessary shortage of money in the, as far as I can tell, there was plenty of money there on both sides. I think that some of the people, particularly the banks, as you know, hedged their bets after the election and gave to both candidates. But the money, as you characteristically follows the success, and if the Republican Party manifests continuous success in getting people elected in North Carolina and in the South, I think that some of the traditional sources of support will go over the party. But I'm not sure that it's significant. And significant in terms of damaging the Democratic Party's chances for contests.
Where are the major sources of financial support politically in North Carolina?
I don't think that you can say. I don't think that's a meaningful question. I think that the sources, you know. The basic sources of support have always been the upper and upper middle classes, professional people, business people, and these people, many of them are ideologically committed to the Democratic Party, but most of them aren't particularly. They contribute on the basis of personal loyalty. They contribute on the basis of perceived success, perceived likelihood of success. The banks have always given money. Some of them, you know, the bank, the dominant bank figures have always given money. You know, the insurance company people have been given money, but far more than they've given, been from the business people. Some of them do business for the state. Some of them don't. Lawyers. I don't sense that there is, you know, any major single source of money in the state.
Is there an identifiable Jewish role in North Carolina politics?
No, not to speak of. I think the Jewish community has, by and large, supported. In fact, been one of the numerically insignificant, but monetarily significant. Not even monetarily significant in terms of supporting candidates. That, at least, that's my impression. Where Jews contribute, they've contributed
pretty much to the Liberal candidate in the Democratic Party and within the Democratic Party, but it's an insignificant amount to speak of. They're individual Jewish businessmen and a few lawyers who have contributed regularly, but it's not a lot. It's, you know, you talk about, God knows, there must not, if I had to sit down and count them up, I bet you I couldn't name more than 15. You know, who have enough money to make contributions, or who have made contributions, you know, in the vicinity of $500 to $1,000 in an election, maybe more than that. But that's just on the basis of my own limited knowledge.
Key called North Carolina a progressive plutocracy. One of the people you could also describe North Carolina as, for the way you get from the more progressive it looks. And when you take all of the social and economic indicators, like per capita income, ranking in terms of education, mental health, and so on, it's at the bottom or close to the bottom. Why does it have that kind of an image firmly still there among the other southern states?
I suppose by comparison with the other southern states, all things being considered, it is probably more enlightened in terms of its governmental ethos, because of the kinds of governmental services which it's given, because of the in many ways the dominant factor in the South, was and probably still is the question of race, and because North Carolina has been less bad than the other southern states on that. That's what really determines whether it's in terms of the category that you're talking about, whether a state is progressive or not progressive.
For example, that hypothesis that's bad.
In the Sanford race, of course, it was. When we were very, you know, much closer to the Supreme Court decision than we are now, you still had a winning candidate who opposed an openly segregationist candidate.
Wasn't Sanford paying lip service to segregation when he occupied the middle road in that campaign in his rhetoric?
Oh, no. Absolutely not. And anybody who tries to paint Malcolm Sewell as being to the left of Terry was crazy. I mean, that's just not the way the election ran.
Well, the hypothesis is advanced, though. It looked vulnerable because it was really never tested from 1954 on, I guess.
Yeah.
No, sorry, 1960 on.
Well, from 1960 on, you know, after Terry's election. It was not an issue. It was not significantly an issue in the Moore election. It was not significantly at issue in the Scott election, though I think, to the extent that he made it an issue, he did what a lot of the Southern politicians do. He made veiled allusions to how he would not tolerate crime in the streets and disorder and things like that.
It was an issue in the Helms race, wasn't it?
What?
It was an issue in the Helms race.
It was to him. It was issue what?
In the Helms race.
Yeah, I think it was an issue in the Helms race, but that's a peculiar situation. That was a really peculiar race. It was peculiar in the sense that the strongest Democratic candidate again assumed that he could win the election without campaigning, and lost the Democratic nomination because of it. And the weaker of the Democratic candidates ended up winning the primary by default, and going into an election which was very heavily influenced by the presidential election. I don't think that race is any kind of indicator of anything, except that if the Democrats are going to win, they're going to have to wage effective campaigns.
How about this hypothesis, though, that North Carolina was in fact more progressive than the other southern states? It had certainly its institutionally, it had its newspapers, it had Chapel Hill, it had the Frank Graham tradition. and blacks were participating to a far larger extent. It was both perceived and real at the time Key was writing. That as a result of that, during the whole civil rights revolution of the 60s, North Carolina got less attention. There was less tension here and less change, less force for change. So to some extent, North Carolina tended to be ignored during much of that conflict relative to the rest of the South.
Speaking of the federal government.
And that as a consequence, North Carolina has changed less, whereas the rest of the South has changed more. And now North Carolina no longer stands out as being different from the rest of the South. It's more another one of the states. You have a smaller percentage of blacks who are registered. You have a smaller percentage of blacks who are registered.
Less federal government attention.
Yeah.
Things just kind of slipped by. And you didn't have the kind of attention that Mississippi and some of the other states had.
Well, I think that's right. But that's what you're saying is that in fact now things are as good in things are as good in Mississippi for blacks as they are in North Carolina, and I don't think that's the case.
Maybe not as good in Mississippi as in North Carolina, but certainly the two are far closer than they were in 1948 or 1965.
I think that's probably true, but look where Mississippi had to come from.
And between North Carolina and South Carolina, is there really a distinction?
Yeah, I think there is a distinction.
What?
I think they're considerable. I think that the conditions and opportunities for blacks in the state in North Carolina are still much better than they are in South Carolina. I don't think that South Carolina has yet gone through the kind of really substantial increase in black opportunities here that North Carolina probably had before the 60s and still does have in greater measure.
Is that just an intuitive feeling or?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how you can. I think the fact that you've got black mayors in Chapel Hill and Raleigh, and the fact that you've got black city councilmen and members of the state legislature, I think is some evidence of that. Increasing black participation in state government, in employment, it's partially intuitive, but I think there are enough facts once you get into it that you could in fact find there was much more than in South Carolina.
My impression is South Carolina a much stronger state human rights law than North Carolina, and a much more aggressive commission to implement those laws.
Well, that may very well be the case, but the question is not what the law is, but what in fact the practice is.
Well, I'm saying in implementing it, that the practice. There are actually more black legislators in North Carolina than South Carolina, as an example.
There are more in North Carolina than South Carolina?
More in South Carolina than in North Carolina.
Well, I would fall back on what the practice seems to be and what the actual opportunities for blacks would seem to be.
The reason we're pursuing that, of course, is that Key's basic hypothesis is that the politics of the South and the politics of race. You understand race politics, you understand Southern politics.
Mm-hmm.
Some people argue that things really haven't changed in 25 years at all.
Well, I don't think that's right.
Maybe some of the language and rhetoric has changed, but basically the situation has not changed.
I don't think that's true. I think that you can no longer say that the politics of the South is the politics of race. I think that it is an element in Southern politics, just as it's an element in the rest of the country, but I think there was a time when it was true. I don't think it's true.
No, to the extent that it's true at all anymore, it's true in a reverse sense of what it was then. What effect race now has is much more of a positive effect than a negative effect. From the standpoint of black participation.
Well, from the standpoint of black participation, but as long as blacks are in a minority, which they are not in some of the large urban areas, it still has enormous potential for making a difference in certain kinds of races and perhaps in all races. It clearly what did make a difference, although there were exceptional circumstances, as I've said, that clearly made a difference in the Jesse Helms race. Jesse Helms elected because
of his known anti-black attitudes. And my guess is that for a good number of years yet, that is going to be one of the problems in statewide races in the South. And it complicated even more because of the increasing visibility and activity of black organizations. You know, so in the sense, on the one hand, you want black organizations, black political organizations to be strong and to take positions and to field candidates. On the other hand, the more they do so, the more visible they become, the more of a public salient threat they constitute to a very large group of people in the state. And so that, you know, as they become more vocal and open, so does their opposition. And under certain circumstances, you know, it becomes very, very difficult to elect a liberal candidate.
Do you see that the North Carolina Party has not really developed into any sort of brought blacks in a really firm coalition?
Yes, I think that's right.
Where do you see the Wallace vote heading in North Carolina in political terms?
Probably into the Republican Party.
Because of the race issue? Or do you think race
entirely
is still predominant over,
yes,
over economics?
I think it is predominant over economics.
Does that suggest to you that this is going to be a strong two-party state?
Well, I think it already is a strong two-party state. And,
you don't think 1972 was an aberration?
I think it was an aberration. I don't think that the Republicans will retain all the strength that they've got now. But I think it's clear that the Republicans are clearly credible opponents at this point in some parts of the state and indeed in statewide elections. And I don't think that, you know, if you look back over the voting returns, North Carolina has always, not always, but for the last 20 to 30 years, always had a fairly sizable Republican vote in statewide elections. So the Republicans, at least for the last, as I recall it, for the last 15 or 20 years, have managed to get somewhere between 35% and 45% of the votes in the general elections. That's a credible two-party situation. And it may very well be that that's peak Republican strength, barring, you know, a major national election in which the Republicans sweep. My guess is that it probably isn't, that in fact the Republican strength will continue to grow some, as it's an inevitable concomitant of industrialization and of Iraq. It means that people are going to have to pay more attention to party organization and the matters of building a Democratic Party organization, rather than as they've done in the past, of worrying only about building factional organizations. The Democratic Party is
what they do with that?
Leaders of
anybody on the scene that can do that.
Well, I think that Luther Hodges Jr. could do it. I doubt very seriously that any of the other state officers could do it. I don't think that Bob Morgan could do it, primarily because I think that he himself is too divisive. He could never get enough of the middle group, and I don't think Jim Hunt can either in a contested situation.
So it leaves it to somebody that's new.
Yep. Not necessarily. It leaves it to somebody who isn't on the scene now. It could, you know, at this point, I suppose that's the same thing as saying new. It's also
new to the leadership.
Well, what I'm saying is that the kind of leadership of the Democratic Party has been factional. What I'm saying is that you need somebody the only kind of leadership that can put the party together is essentially consensus leadership, not factional leadership. And I think that Terry could have done that. I don't think he can anymore because he's got other things that he wants to do, unless he were going to spend full time at it or go at it with some perceived goal of election. But I think that it takes a certain kind of person to do it, who is basically non-factional, much more consensus, much more of a consensus figure, and you know, there aren't very many of those people around. I think Luther happens to be one who is, but I don't know of very many others.
Would he have to take a more active political role to do that?
Yes, I think he would.
What do you see as the legacy of the Sanford administration? Did it have a permanent impact in North Carolina?
That's a very hard question. I really don't know that I can answer it. There's no question in my mind about what the Sanford administration did with respect to a number of areas of state policy that had not been done before and have subsequently and not been done since, particularly a lot of the new innovative educational programs that Sanford started that are still going, and indeed are not only still going, but are in many cases the only kinds of things that are going like that in the country. The School of the Arts, the Governor's School, the attempt to continue to improve the public schools and the system of higher education.